Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this.
Talks between the teachers' union and the provincial government were started in the spring, but by the end of October, the contract ran out without a settlement. Then in October, frustrated by the lack of movement, the elementary and secondary teachers' unions decided to hold a vote to go on strike. Already, elementary school teachers gave a resounding 98% approval to go on strike. The secondary school teachers will announce their strike vote results sometime around November 17th. Locally, votes are being held for secondary school teachers. One was done earlier this week in Baltimore, I believe, to discuss the background and impact of a possible teacher strike in Northumberland. I am grateful to have on the line with me now Eileen Fletcher, Vice President of District 14 of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Union. Welcome, Eileen.
Hi, how are you?
Very
good.
Thank
you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. The Ontario government announced it is capping wage increases to 1% per year for the next 3 years for the entire public sector, including school boards. What's the impact of this new legislation on the current negotiations?
Well, I think there'll be a significant impact. I think the concern really is that that's a direct violation of our collective bargaining rights. And so we are very concerned that the government persisted in passing this bill at this time. It just, the timing is really unconscionable.
Well, interesting you should mention the timing, because I wonder to what extent the government is now boxing the union into a corner. I mean, it's going to change the focus that you've been having over the last number of months about issues related to class size and other things that you've been talking about. And now all of a sudden it's going to become about salaries. Does that sort of create a situation for you if you do go on strike where, you know, everybody's going to be focused on how much you get paid rather than the other issues that you've been trying to profile?
I don't think that's the case at all. In fact, we've continued to make the reasonable request that we track to inflation so that salaries will stop being a focus of the conversations that we're having at the bargaining table. There are provisos within Bill 124 to sort of have some flexibility around that. So I'm hoping moving forward that this isn't going to end up being a sticking point and that we'll continue, certainly in our conversations, to ensure that we're putting students' needs and interests at the forefront of the conversations that we're having. We continue to bring what we think are important issues to the table, and the stalling that's occurring is really very frustrating for teacher members.
No doubt. But when, you know, the average individual listening to the show hears that, you know, there's a possibility of a teacher strike, what do you think goes through their minds? What sort of things pops in the average person's mind when they hear there's this possibility that there may be a strike?
Well, I think the public is concerned about the same things we're concerned about. Teachers really, they want to be in their classrooms. It, you know, working with students is what brings them the most joy in their job. And that's where we want to be. Teachers want to be in the classroom working with students. They want to have that opportunity. Nobody wants to be on strike, and I think that that's important to recognize. And we have continued to say it's not just important that students are in class, but that they're in quality classrooms and that we have an opportunity for students to work with a reasonable number of adults in the building so that we aren't reducing the number of caring adults that students have access to, so that they're getting the support and that we're not losing programs. These are really important issues to be addressing with this government.
Okay, so let's dig in a little bit deeper on those, because I think maybe not all of our listeners understand what you're specifically talking about. Now, there's been talk that 10,000 teachers could lose their positions over under the current configuration that the government's proposing.
Correct.
How does that affect the quality of education in the classroom? Can you describe it in some detail so that we better understand what you mean when you talk about the quality of education?
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is the opportunity to have sufficient pathways or destination opportunities. So the types of courses that we're able to offer in the school are diminished when there are fewer teachers in the building, right? So it limits how many courses students have actual access to. And, you know, in my personal history, so prior to becoming a bargaining unit president, I have been a head of guidance for 16 years, and I have, at the very core of that, always championed for those students that are the most vulnerable, that are the most challenged around school engagement. And we want to make sure that there are enough caring adults in the building in order to ensure that they're being supported. In addition to that, as soon as you reduce the number of adults that are in the building, then the other opportunities that enrich an education experience also start to diminish. So, you know, the number of extracurriculars might be changed, the number of people the number of hours that a teacher can spend or time that a teacher can spend with any individual student in a class, because as class sizes continue to grow, then the individual student is getting less and less time. So I think that those really impact the quality of education. We're already seeing the impact. We're having pathways that are not being offered within some of our schools. We have lost many of our option courses. So we're finding that students are being forced into courses that they may not necessarily have chosen as their first choice. And so the possibility of disengagement is much higher for those students.
So when you're talking about pathways, because that tends to be a bit of lingo, what are you talking about there? Can you give us an example of what that might mean in practical terms?
Yeah, for sure. So we know that not all students obviously head off to university or college, that we have other pathways that students take beyond beyond secondary school. So we have students who go directly into the world of work or into apprenticeships, and approximately one-third of all students graduating in the province of Ontario actually do not go on to a post-secondary institution directly out of high school. So for those one-third of a student, or one-third of our students, we want to make sure that there are opportunities for them to get the appropriate background and learning that they need to be successful heading into the workplace. So when we talk about pathways, we're talking about where the ultimate destination is for students and how can we work with those partners, so either industry partners, placements in the community, or the college partners we have or the university partners we have in terms of preparing students best for the destination of their choice. And that begins sort of in high school. We start in grade 9 and 10 with a more general program, but get into specialization years in grade 11 and 12. But when we reduce the number of teachers who are in the school system and within our schools, then we end up not being able to offer as many options in grade 11 and 12 to give them the rich sort of specialization that they need for the destination of their choice.
I can imagine that there might be some people listening that would say, look, you know, do we really need all this enriching? Can we not just stick to the fundamentals and just do that? And why do we need all these extra things that you use the term enrich their learning experience?
Well, I think part of that obviously goes to motivation for students and keeping them engaged. And I think most people, when they reflect back on their own school experience, will remember not necessarily sort of the fundamentals, which we deliver at a very high level in Ontario. We have a second to none, in my opinion, education system. But it's those other experiences that we have. So it's the courses where we start to get to specialize and really engage in those things that we're interested in. So when we're talking about losing out on technology courses, for example, those are the fundamentals for students going on in those destinations. So we talk about them in terms of being options or enrichment, but they aren't options or enrichment. They are very much a critical part of the learning for those students choosing that particular pathway or direction in life. And certainly when we talk about subjects like music or art or drama that enhance the creativity of students, that creativity is one of the leading skills that employers today are saying they want to see in the people that they are hiring. So we need to continue to encourage the opportunity for students to have those kinds of experiences so that we're working on the complete person. It's not always about, you know, numbers and words, right? It's not just a literacy and numeracy agenda.
Okay. One of the things you alluded to early in your remarks mm-hmm. was you talked a bit about class size. And I know that the mm-hmm. government has said that they want to up the class size from 22 to 28 students. Now, mm-hmm. some people might say, well, you know, what the heck? That's just six more kids in a classroom. Really, is it that bad? Why is this such a concern for you as a union?
Well, there are a number of impacts. So the important thing to recognize here is that we're not talking about an actual cap, a hard cap of that's how many students you would have. We're talking about an average. And we've already seen with the implementation, and it's been, you know, what would be normally construed as a very minor adjustment, we're already seeing classes locally that are blooming to, you know, 38-1. And when that happens, the students lose out on the opportunity to have the individual help that they would need to be successful. We know that face-to-face learning for our students and having opportunities to ask questions and get the support they need is critical by having class sizes that are on average lower. The other piece of that is really that sorry, I just lost my train of thought. The other piece is, I'm going to stop there because my mind went one place and then I lost it.
That's all right.
I'll try and circle
back. That happens to me all the time, so not to worry about it at all. So now, one of the other things that the government talks about is online learning.
Oh, I know what I was going to say now.
Oh,
but okay, go ahead.
Let's go back. So we're talking about average class sizes. So go ahead.
Yeah. So the other piece is I often hear members of the public talking about how, in my day we had classes of 30-1 and there was no mm-hmm. issues. And part of the challenge is that we now have a fully integrated education system in that all students with all levels of needs are integrated in the same classroom. So the demands that we're seeing in any given classroom mm-hmm. are much higher. So that also impacts the ability to sort of address and move the class forward in their learning when you're dealing with more and more challenges within a given classroom. So it's a very different, classrooms look very different today than they did, say, 30 years ago when I began in education.
So what are some of these special needs? Because I know that's another issue that the union raises is the, mm-hmm. the special education, but can you maybe explain a bit more about these children or these young people with special needs that, you know, we may not understand, you know, we just figure everybody, you know, that we always had a classroom where there was a couple of people that were a little slower than the rest and there was a couple that excelled. What are you talking about when you're talking about these special needs?
Well, I mean, there are any number of issues that arise. So we have students, obviously, who have individual education plans that address their specific needs, and there's an increasing number there. We also have an influx of students who speak English, that are English language learners, so that adds a new level of complication for sure. We have students who are struggling with issues like mental health. We've seen an increasing number of those students, and we address students as a complete person, right? We want to ensure that their needs are being met in every aspect. So education is no longer really just looking at the ABCs and 1-2-3s. We approach students as a complete person, and those complications can certainly affect the way in which a class might be approached.
One of the things that the provincial government has offered to as an alternative for having fewer teachers is that they want to introduce a minimum of online learning courses. I think that's 4 that they want a student to take in post-secondary. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, not post-secondary, but secondary school. So what's the impact of that according to the union?
Well, as you know, centrally, if you've been on our Bargaining for Education website, you know that centrally we want to be consulted on these things. And we believe at this point there has been no consultation whatsoever, and that it's not really about modernizing an education. It really is an attempt to deliver a bargain basement education through the cheapest means possible. There's no guarantee that the people delivering those e-learning credits would be qualified teachers. There's no guarantee that it's not going to be farmed out, that the standards will be the same. We know that many students require that in-person contact and support. We've seen that there are some students who can be successful, but that many students struggle with an online learning environment. So we know that putting 4 mandatory online credits for every single student will lower the graduation rates that we're seeing coming out of our high schools. And we have worked very, very hard since the Harris years to raise those graduation rates to very excellent levels, you know, having raised them more than 20% in terms of those rates. So it's very disconcerting for us to see that would become. And in the most recent sort of references that the ministry has been making, they're comparing it to programs in Alabama and Michigan, mm-hmm. and we know that they are not ranked as well in terms of education globally as our current system. So we're concerned that that's what they're using as a reference.
So what would make online learning or e-learning something that would be valuable to the system?
I mean, currently we do have e-learning that's happening, right? For those students who require it in order to get a program, if they're in smaller schools or rural schools, and then making sure that there are in-school supports for that. So that if you have, say, 20 students in the school who are taking an e-learning course, that there is a face-to-face support, an education person who is there to assist with that. And that would certainly help support that, but that's not what they're proposing at this time. As I said, there's been no consultation, and what we've asked for, I think, is that before they forge ahead with this particular agenda, that there is a conversation and a fulsome thought about what the consequences are of just randomly sort of making this compulsory.
We talked a bit about salaries in the government's recent announcement, or yesterday's announcement, but I want to go back a bit and cover a couple of points on that, because it's been interesting to read what the union has said. By the way, what made you take the unusual step of making your bargaining proposals public? Because I know I went to your bargainingforeducation.ca. Why did you take that strategy compared to other years?
It was an interesting strategy, and I think that what's really important is that, you know, starting back in March, the government was already sort of taking bargaining to the public. They were making sweeping statements about teachers and what we were asking for. So laying the bargaining brief bare in this way sort of prevents them from creating an image that we're being unreasonable in our asks. And I think anyone who's had an opportunity to actually read through the negotiations recognizes that everything that's there, it's about students, it's about improving the learning environments for our kids, and it's about reasonable compensation for that. There's nothing there that can be there's no narrative that they can tell that will cause angst within the public, and I think that's really important that the public understand that as educators who are working with their children in our communities, that really is our priority, is ensuring the learning environment for students. And everything we've asked for is in alignment with that, including even the stuff around compensation, so that teachers can focus on learning going forward and focus on classrooms. We don't want to continue to have the conversation about salaries or make that a focus in any way, shape, shape or form.
Well, you're going to have to forgive me because I'm going to go back to talking about salaries because that was the one part of it that was a little bit confusing to me. And that is every time you've bargained in the past, you have got seen increases. And there are mechanisms within the salary grid that allow salaries to go up. But yet in, mm-hmm. in the website, the union argues that teachers have faced a decrease in salary. Can you help us understand how you got to that point?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, inflation has an impact, right, in terms of how a salary is viewed against the cost of living. And so when inflation is outpacing any salary increases that, that anybody in any labor organization receives, then in fact that's viewed as a loss because the take-home or what you're able to do with that money that you're taking home is decreased. So it has that impact for sure.
Okay. It's my understanding that the bargaining that goes on, it takes place at two levels. There's a provincial level, which your union is represented and talks directly to the government. But I also understand that there are also local negotiations that go on. Can you tell us some of the issues that are not being discussed at a provincial level that are being talked about at the local level that have the teachers in the Kawartha Pine Ridge Public School Board concerned?
So the difference between our local negotiations and our central negotiations is that our local negotiations actually are taking a more traditional approach. So the bargaining briefs are not being made available to the public and will not be made available to the public. We have a very different relationship with our employer, our local employer, than we do centrally with the government. And so the tactics are going to be different for sure.
But what are the issues that are on the table? Can you discuss any of those?
Not really. We did actually have a negotiation meeting today, so we have begun local negotiations, and we'll be talking about those things that we're permitted to in terms of local. So it pertains to things like working conditions, it may pertain to access to work, those kinds of things. So there are sort of general, broad, sweeping things. All of the money pieces were taken to central. Negotiations, so it really has more to do with process and procedures and the way in which we communicate with each other.
So after the government's actions yesterday and all the things that we've spent the last few minutes talking about, is a strike inevitable?
You know, I think that a really strong mandate by our bargaining units across the province certainly doesn't mean that it's inevitable. I think that what it does is it sends a signal that we're very serious about these negotiations, and what we haven't seen from the other side so far is as them taking them seriously with a lot of tactics to delay conversations at the table. We want to have these conversations. We continue to set bargaining dates, even at the time that we will be in a legal strike position should the vote go through by teacher members. We still have bargaining dates in the weeks that occurs and the weeks that follow, and we hope to have fulsome discussions at the negotiation table, and that there's a resolution. As I mentioned before, you know, teachers want to be in class. We want to be working with our students.
Aileen Fletcher, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. I know there's
You're
a lot of parents
welcome.
Out there and grandparents that are listening keenly to figure out what's going to come next. So thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you so much. When we come back, Nancy Johnson, Executive Director of Cornerstone Family Violence Prevention Center, will join me. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back.